Fasano, and we are underway for the fourth virtual MotoGP race. It's a cool start from Alex Marquez. Meanwhile, Valentino Rossi gets sandwiched on the way to turn one, and down goes Pecco Bagnaia.
Hello and welcome to MotoPod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle racing. This is episode number 635. I'm one of your hosts, Skyler Vicroy, and joining me, as ever, is Jim McDowell. Jim, how's it going?
It's going pretty good. Back to work. I think the world is, or at least the states are starting to open up now to where we're doing different things and people are now back running around. There used to be no traffic on the road and now there's traffic again, so maybe this is a sign we'll get closer to motorcycle racing.
It does look that way. Even here in California, we're starting to slowly open up certain businesses. A lot of companies are going over opening plans, how they plan on going moving forward, so on and so forth. And I can definitely tell that there's more people on the road, because even going and grabbing lunch, leaving the house once or twice a week has gotten a lot busier. So it's good that things are moving toward a more normal, well, whatever normal is after all of this life. But like you said, it's like there's racing. They're starting to talk about getting calendars together, getting races together, and we'll touch on that in a little bit. But Jim, as always, we gotta start the show off proper.
Yes, please do.
Alrighty.
That's good.
It is good. Now, I've had this one on the show before. This is leftovers from the weekend when I had some drop-offs here of beer from a buddy that was swinging by the house. Don't worry, we kept our social distance, everybody. It's just a beer delivery, don't trip. But he brought me some of my favorite one, and that's that the offshoot brewing company, which is the Relax Hazy IPA.
So still about good. Another still 10 minutes and you're going to be like completely useless.
Yeah, I'm not going to lie, like, you know, I'm just going to sit here and be okay. I had a beer for dinner. It was a small beer though, not one of these large cans. That's what's killer about these cans. These are like double the beer. These are like 16-ounce cans. So
old school.
Yeah, exactly. So you get some of those going, and next thing you know, you're, oh, it was one time I was running, but no, you don't want to get into that. So, but anyway, on to the show. So in the show, we're going to be going over some listener feedback. We actually have some really cool versions. I have been working on getting some know-how on doing recording and entering in sounds that people or files or whatever it is, so that we can play sounds during the show and me and Jim can kind of listen to them live and enjoy it like we're enjoying it with you. That took a little while. It also took a while for me to do that because in order for me to finally get my computer to act right, I had to wipe the whole drive. The computer was just, I had some like malware on there, I don't know, a couple years ago, and I just could not get it off. And it was just that time. I didn't need a fresh install, and you computer nerds will know that how soothing it is to have a fresh install on your computer and how fast and smooth everything runs. But yeah, so it took a little bit to get that up, a little bit to get going. So we are a little bit late getting the show out, but it is good to be back, isn't it, Jim?
It is good to be back. It breaks up the monotony of going to work every day now and sitting in my cube with a mask and gloves and anyway.
Oh, good times. Alrighty, oh, yeah. So now, We're starting to go with this. Well, what do you want to do? You want to go into the recordings, or do you want to kind of go over some like gossip? I wouldn't call it news. It's pretty much gossip at this point.
I like gossip. What's all right? Gossip.
Perfect. Alrighty. So, recent gossip is that Jack Miller is close to sealing a move over to the factory Ducati team for 2021.
Shock.
That's not really a big shock. I think we all kind of expected that was going to happen. And I think Ducati's going to use this as, they're going to watch Dovizioso's performance this year. And if he can deliver, because he wants a big contract, they may want to give it to him. But at the same time, they're going to look at return on investment, right? Like, you're not getting to your top anymore. You're probably winding it down. And how much do we want to attach ourselves, or do we want to give, you know, let you roll away for the year? Give Petrucci a one-year contract and wait until everybody else's is up in a year or so and see if we can snag anybody else over to our team.
Yeah, I think Dovizioso is nearing the end. That's just an opinion, but he hasn't had a bike that's probably as good as what he thinks he should have, but also Miller has been riding the wheels off of the Ducati that he's been given, and Ducati kind of likes those kind of people, so it only makes sense that he would be there. I think Petrucci is not long for a factory seat and probably not long for MotoGP anyway. I think his weight and size is his big disadvantage. So I think you add it all up, you might get Dovizioso on maybe a 1 or 2 year extension for equal money, that for equivalent money now, maybe a little raise, but Miller is going to get a bigger, longer deal.
Yeah, I think that's all accurate. I would agree with pretty much all those points. So another Ducati rider, or test rider, I should say, Michel Pirro, thinks it was suspicion that wildcard rides got banned for this year. So in case you missed that bit of news, they announced that no wildcard riders will be able to ride this season due to a truncated season, or the way that it's going to be maybe pulling double events. They just figured, let's not enter in as, we need to remove some parts that we can, basically, at this point. It's like, all right, we're going to have all this craziness. We don't need to worry about bringing in other riders who aren't here full season and can affect the championship. But
yep.
Michel Pirro thinks to himself, he goes, you know what? I think this is revenge, because Michel Pirro gets at least, you know, 2-3 rides a year, and he thinks this is Honda taking a stab at Jorge Lorenzo, saying, oh, you want to leave us and go be a test rider, and then you're going to get 2 or 3 test rides that, you know, may affect how the championship goes, and maybe it's, you know, Vinales and Marquez are doing their thing, and you get their mess with it. Well, we don't want you here. So, of course, you know, everyone bends the knee to HRC because they hold the power in MotoGP, so they're thinking, oh, okay, there may be some truth to that, but then again... Cool. I personally think this is Dorna removing an element of craziness from this year that they actually could, and realistically, test riders are test riders.
I think you're totally right. I think it's just Dorna redoing what it is in this time. Hey, why do you, we don't need any more people in the paddock than what we already have. Yep. That's the first thing. Okay. So if we're going to do this, and as the rumors are right now, we're talking about starting in Spain and running all 4 of the tracks in Spain, right? On like an every weekend kind of a deal. So if you add more people to the paddock, that's more testing or more chances of continuing on. So I agree with you. I think it's a Dorna thing. However, I do love the HRC conspiracy theory, because if we know one thing for certain, Honda gets whatever Honda wants in the series. And if you don't believe me, I give you the rookie rule that screwed Ben Spies out of a factory ride is when he first came into MotoGP, but yet that rule got lifted for one Marc Marquez.
So, and that's just one of the many examples.
That's just the most obvious one that has come about. There's, you know, we could go back to the idea that we quit racing 500 two-strokes because Honda said they wanted a 4-stroke class, and they got it. We could even go there if we need to. So,
exactly.
Anyway, moving on.
Moving on. So some Suzuki news. Suzuki is continuing to work towards finding a satellite team for the 2022 season. This is, I think, been a rumor that's been going on for a while, that Suzuki's been wanting to do this because, of course, having more riders, more input, development can be a bit faster, right? And if you look at everybody else in the paddock, for the most part, they do run satellite team, including the new kids on the block, KTM. So, you know, the only ones who don't are Aprilia, very small outfit, so we probably won't really ever see that. But Suzuki definitely, you know, they've gotten to the point now where their development is so good and their bikes are so good that they're running in that top 5 category and grabbing the occasional win, that it looks like they're ramping, you know, getting ready to ramp up, make the push towards the front to get on the podium more regularly if they're going to be adding a satellite team.
Yep. So my question to you is, who do you think gets that satellite team?
Well, now that's a good question, because with the way that the rules are now, someone's got to get pushed out, right? Right, exactly. Or bought out, changed, pushed out. I mean, at this point, it's got to be one of the Ducati teams.
But which one? Come on.
Who's got the biggest pockets at that point?
I think you know who I'm thinking of. Come on.
Aventia?
Yes. Yeah. I think Aventia goes that way.
That'd be a smart move.
If you're a Ventia, are you going to want to stay with year-old or maybe two-year-old Ducatis when you could get essentially the same bike as Suzuki has? Mm-hmm. I think you go that. I mean, I think it's a no-brainer, provided they can come up with the money to be able to do it. And here's the other part of this that I think it's Aventia, right? Zarco signed to ride for Aventia, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And we know Zarco does not lend itself to a V4 Ducati.
Ooh, I think I know where Jim's going with this.
Yes, you do. It doesn't lead itself to a V4 engine. Mm-hmm. But he was damn fast on an inline Yamaha. Mm-hmm. You put Zarco on a satellite Suzuki, I'm telling you, that's top five week in, week out.
Well, Suzuki's all about cornering, and that's what definitely know Zarco is about, right? It's finesse, uh-huh. smoothness. He's very much like Lorenzo in his style, and that Suzuki would definitely suit him.
Oh, yeah. Zarco on a Suzuki would be something I would love to see. Just because of what he did on a Yamaha. He did that on a year-old Yamaha, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you get him on, even if he had last year's Suzuki, which that bike is no slouch
mm-hmm.
at all, none. You get him on another inline four, Zarco's going to make some magic happen. Easy, mm-hmm. easy top tens. Easy.
I'll give you another route for that, though, right? Okay, this is another puzzle piece because
we
have one, Valentino Rossi, who obviously is on the factory team, and he's going to be stepping over to most likely everyone thinks he's going to go to Petronas, but contracts are not finished. Apparently they just started talking. This is more gossip. They just started talking within the last week or two of negotiating a deal. And, you know, Petronas is already making a big chest out stand. Like, we're not changing anything because Rossi's coming here. We're still functioning the same way we are. Sure. We'll see how much pull he has. But if Rossi decides, like, he goes to the, he's like, you know what? I'm gonna go on a 1+1 contract, meaning I'll do this year and I wanna leave myself the option to walk away, or I can, you know, go ahead and just pick up the option if I want to, and I'm guaranteed this seat, right? Something along those lines. Because he wants to see, like, do I wanna do satellite? Goes up there and, you know, it's just not working out, you can just walk away, but I'm done. But then that leaves the seat open for 22. Oh, see now. We can make Zarco walk back onto that Yamaha where he's felt comfortable, do a Jorge Lorenzo and sneak on back into that Yamaha paddock. I don't know, man. That could be a dangerous weapon, too.
Yeah, but Zarco is not a spring chicken. I mean,
that he is not.
He's almost as old as Dovizioso, right?
You know, I made a stab at his age. Oh, a year or two. We're talking back in Moto 2, and I made him about 5 years older than what he actually was at the time. So I am not going to do that mistake again. So I'd have to look up to see how old he is.
Yeah.
I would say he's around my age. So I'm 35. So
yeah.
I think that puts me in a safe bet. I think he's younger than me. But
yeah, I think Zarco is 32 now.
Yeah, I think so as well.
That's my best guess. Yeah. From what I remember. And Dovizioso has got to easily be 30 or 31. So. Yeah. I mean, that doesn't mean anything. Look at Rossi. He's 40. He's still going strong. So, it you know, today with the nutrition, the workout regimens, the science behind it all, hey, it's really good, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, age doesn't really mean much. It's more what injuries have you sustained during that time.
And there's also the whole thing of the Moto2 kids, right? Who's coming? Because there may be a talent that rises up that we're not aware of yet in the next 1 or 2 years, and it's like, oh crap, we got to bring this guy on the bike. Right? Sorry, nope, not gonna happen. Old guards out. We got to bring these kids up because I mean, we're seeing it in motorsports right now at a insane rate. How fast everything got young really quick. MotoGP got young really fast. We're seeing F1 right now is going through that immensely, where it's like, oh, okay. You're going to come in and race the top dogs. I mean, here's Marc Marquez, Fabio Quartararo. I mean, these guys are 20 or younger when they come into GP and just start running at the front. That was unheard of before, you know? You had to put in years and walk across when you were 25 and be like, oh, okay. Then you put in your 5 years, you're 30, then you're back out of the sport because now you're too old. It's like, oh, that went fast. So, anyway. So, yeah, there's some gossip for you, some really fun stuff. There's some more COVID stuff, such as, like, Carmelo Ezpeleta was saying that They're not going to run any of the world championship races in Asia unless spectators can be present for those races. So the plan right now, I think the rough sketch is that they're going to run a season, which is all European based, pretty much from July into September. And a good chunk of those races will be spectator free, which would be like, you know, only necessary personnel will be at the track itself. And then from there, I mean, we're talking like even the commentators might be in a truck outside the track or something like that, not even being on grounds, like that strict. And then from there, they're going to be weighing, you know, how everything is going, and then possibly in September release an outside, you know, flyaway rounds such as, you know, Japan, Malaysia, Kota, Phillip Island, all of those races, any flyaway races, they're going to be waiting until almost, they're going to say they, if they do go into those races, they're going to go all the way into mid-December this yep. year. So like you mentioned, they're doing like all the Spanish rounds back to back to back. Mm-hmm. They're doing doubles at some events, so they're racing two races over the weekend. It could yep. be a very crazy season.
I think it's going to be crazy. It's going to be crazy because there's going to be no Assen. That's canceled. It's just not happening. Mm-hmm. Saxon mm-hmm. canceled. Not happening. The race in Finland and the Kimi Ring canceled. Not going to yep. happen.
Yep. Right?
It looks, I mean, from what I saw, hey, we're starting out in Spain. We're going to run all these places in Spain. Then they're kind of looking at like running Mugello, San Marino in Italy and getting that part done. Maybe doing some double rounds there. Then, you know, maybe heading to Silverstone because they're going to have the precedent of Formula One having been there and mm-hmm. raced. And there's going to be the procedures that are going to be there for that. So they'll just sort of follow that along. So
well, they had, speaking of Formula One, I did see that they don't have to, but what they're doing now, because they're smart, is they're waiting for Formula One's calendar to come out before they make any solid decisions. So yeah. if some of you are probably like booing that right now, don't get it twisted. Formula One is still top dog. So when they have a race weekend, you don't want to be stepping into that TV audience room. You're going to lose a big crowd of people.
Well, unless you can be an eight-hour time difference.
Mm-hmm.
So
definitely things to think about going forward with the schedule. But, you know, just stay fluid. It's going to be changing constantly until the green flag is dropped at the first race of the season. And even then, we're probably still going to be making changes all the way until 2021.
Yep.
All right. So that's pretty much it for the gossip. We had some emails come in this week, but we'll get to those in a second. I'm just itching to get to this audio stuff because I worked so freaking hard on it to get it to work, Jim. So let's just get down to it. All right, so what we're going to do here is we're going to start with some audio submissions that were sent to us. And the first one comes from Doug. Now, Doug sent us this video or this audio recording some weeks ago when me and Jim were talking on the show. We talked about our crashes and our injuries. And so he came in and said, hey, I've got a great story for you. He actually kind of started this new idea that we have, like, hey, it's kind of cool to have people send in recordings and not just read emails off, because everybody gets tired of hearing me and Jim stumble through what they've already put up there. So having recordings are pretty cool. So let's go ahead and give this a listen, and me and Jim will react at the end.
I hope I can figure out a way to send you guys this recording. I don't have professional recording equipment. You guys just inspired me to share these two stories with you, and you're more than welcome to share the punchlines on your next episode. I'm sure you're going to get a ton of these sorts of stories. So the first one is my worst motorcycle accident ever, and I'm not going to give you the whole detail. I'm just going to tell you the funniest part because I want to make this short. So I was young and dumb. I was 17. I had my first motorcycle that it was actually mine. I had learned to ride previously on dirt bikes and my dad's bikes and so on. This was my motorcycle. And I had two different ways to get to my apartment. And I decided at the very last second, you know what, instead of taking the surface streets, this is in Charlotte, North Carolina, I was going to cut a hard right onto the on-ramp to get on the highway. It's just one exit, so it was same distance, but it looked like there's a lot of traffic in front of me. I'll just use the exit, and I'll use the highway instead. Get on, get off. Of course, I'm on a cruiser. I cut the corner super hard. Don't know how to ride it correctly anyway. I don't know anything about counter steering at 17 years old. hit the all the gravel and stuff that gathers, you know, at the on-ramp off of a surface street onto a highway in any sort of city where you haven't it hadn't rained maybe in a week or two. Immediately, the bike low sides from out from underneath me, slide into the median doing about 30, 35 miles an hour, which on a cruiser at a 90-degree turn is way too fast for a 17-year-old kid that doesn't know how to do it. The bike immediately flips over the median, so it was sort of like a high side, even though I technically low sided. It high sides me off the bike. I go launching over an entire lane of traffic. Thankfully, there were no cars in the lane, but I cleared the entire. It was one of those on ramps where one on the on ramp is the one lane, and then the opposing lane is the adjacent off ramp. So I basically cleared the off ramp. And as I'm flying through the air, I can see the ditch coming up, and it's a grassy ditch, so I kind of already can tell I'm not going to be too terribly hurt from this. But as I'm flying through the air, I distinctly remember saying to myself, "My bike!" And I roll and tumble through the grass, yes. And I trashed that bike. But the story I really wanted to share with you guys is not a motorcycle crash story, although it is similar to the story of having your wounds abraded. So in 1998, I was 18 years old now, so this is a year after I trashed that bike. And I was big into rollerblading. It was the 90s. Rollerblading was cool. And I was going to college at North Carolina State University in Raleigh. North Carolina State is right downtown for people that aren't familiar with it. And I worked at Starbucks at the time. I was your typical college freshman. And I would rollerblade everywhere. I'd rollerblade to class. I'd rollerblade to work. Well, there was a Starbucks right across the street from the campus, and that's the one I worked at. And it was maybe half a mile from my dorm. I lived in a really typical, you know, college dorm. But there was another Starbucks about 2.5 miles away, and sometimes you could pick up shifts over at that Starbucks. So we all knew each other. Everybody from the college worked at those two Starbuckses. And sometimes I'd pick up a shift over there, and I'd just rollerblade over there. It was all surface streets. It was in the city. And, I mean, I was actually pretty good. I was the kind of guy who would, like, pull the whole Michael J. Fox grab onto the back of the truck thing, and I did it a lot, and it does work. So I'm rollerblading on my way to that Starbucks, and the last little bit to that shopping center is a downhill. And I'm just hauling ass down this hill. And I'd gone down this hill numerous times. It was actually, you know, actually pretty safe considering I knew what I was doing. All the cars around me were used to that, and it wasn't a major street. It was kind of a smaller street, no real stop signs. There were some stop lights. Well, I'm coming up to an intersection, and there was some slower traffic. The traffic was going slower than me at that point. So my thinking is I'm going to move over to the sidewalk, which again, I know how to do. I've done numerous times. In the 90s was when they started putting up those skateboard and rollerblade stopping things. You've seen the yellow rubber pads with the bumps in them. And then, you know, they're supposed to stop you from basically the reason they say they put them up there is to help wheelchair people, you know, stop from rolling into traffic. But everybody I've ever known who's in a wheelchair, like permanently, they can operate those things better than most people can walk. So I truly don't believe they put those up for wheelchair accessibility at all. Most of the people I know in wheelchairs are badass.
So to take a quick break there, because my mom is a mobility and orientation instructor, and those raised bumps that are on the ground are actually for the blind to detect when they're coming up to an intersection there.
That's,
so
that's what I was going to say. It's for the blind. It has nothing to do with wheelchairs. Right. It's all like, right. That's why it's bullshit.
All that's right, we'll jump so back into the story.
Those things. I think they put them up just to stop people from rollerblading and skateboarding. Well, I had never seen one of these things before. Like I said, these things were just starting to come into use. I'm going faster than traffic, which it's about a 20 mile an hour zone. So I'm doing somewhere between 20 and 30 miles an hour on my rollerblades. I cut off of the main street to get onto the sidewalk. Now, 20 years later, I know how to jump over those things. I didn't know any better. I just hit that thing at 30 miles an hour and just slammed into the sidewalk. Tumble, roll, just like you're describing. I was all just cut up, and like I was wearing a pair of pants, thankfully. I was wearing my work pants and a t-shirt, but I was just blood everywhere. And I get to the Starbucks, you know, basically I don't work that day because I look like hell, but my coworkers there help clean me up, and I go back to my dorm. Well, the next morning I have to wake up to open the Starbucks there at my campus that I normally work at. Of course, opening a Starbucks is early morning affair. So, you know, I slept all night with my wounds as clean as I could get them. And I knew I needed to shower before I go to work because I was going to look like hell no matter what. So I get into the shower. Maybe it's 4:30 in the morning. You know, I think our Starbucks opened at like 6, so I had to be there at 5:30 to start turning things on. So it's like 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning. I get in the shower, and it's just like you said. As soon as that water hit me, the pain. It was just so intense. And I'm in the shower. And the bathroom is completely empty. This is a co-ed dorm, but of course, you know, one floor is men, one floor is women, you know, men. Of course, none of us obeyed that. Well, at least we usually obeyed it on the girls' floor because we'd get in a lot of trouble. But hey, if you had a girl spend the night in your room, she'd just go use the guy's bathroom. It's not like she couldn't just use the stall and nobody would see it. Nobody cared. We didn't care. They didn't care. I'm in the shower. I'm in the bathroom all by myself. I'm taking a shower, and all you can hear coming from my stall in the shower is... And I hear somebody's girlfriend or whoever, somebody's girl, come into the bathroom to use the bathroom, and I kind of hear her say something, so I could tell it was a girl's voice, and she kind of pauses at the doorway. She hears me in the shower making those noises, and I just hear the door never even closed. You know, she just turned right around, and then I heard the door close, and she just left. She didn't want to know what I was doing in there.
Oh, my God.
That is absolutely positively classic. Oh, I mean, honestly, great. It's one of the funniest, one of the more funny stories I've ever heard. And the fact that he did it with rollerblades and didn't even have a motorcycle involved in this one.
Right.
Just makes it that much funnier.
I didn't even pre-listen to this. I just let it roll. I was like, oh, okay, we're just going to go into a story about rollerblades. Sure. But that ending was great. Perfect. Man.
Thank you, sir, for the humility, Doug, of that.
That was great. But so he had a little bit to add in his email, too. So he wanted to bring up, he said he really enjoyed our stories about great corners, racist rides, and crashes, and particular stories of our crashes, the road rash, and that's what made him send in the story that he wanted to send in. But he said that in the first story that he told about his worst crash, he was actually saying that it's actually wrong, because that wasn't his worst crash. He forgot that he crashed, I guess, that bike. Ooh, that poor bike. I can't talk. Mine went through 7. At the on-ramp at a story that included an audio attachment. Okay, so I should probably learn to read ahead. But anyway, his worst crash, he goes, he told that bike a few months later when he was traveling at the speed limit on an empty six-lane surface street divided by a median. It was extremely early, around about 5:15 a.m. As I crested the bridge overpass of the highway underneath me, I saw the red 1984 Ford Ranger waiting to turn left. So you can tell this was not going to, you know, end well, because he can tell you everything about that car, which means everything went into slow motion for him at this time.
Yes.
And then he said, oh, yeah. And so he said the Ranger waited till he was all about 50 feet away, and then he crossed the 3 empty opposing lanes of the road, crossed through the gap in the median that was meant for people to turn left, you know, when there's not oncoming traffic, and finally came out directly in front of me when he was going 50 miles per hour in a 45 mile per hour zone, about 12 feet in front of him. Thankfully, he couldn't hit and run me, though, as I was in the bed of his truck. Wow. So he ended up running into the truck and launching into the bed of his truck. Doug, I gotta tell you, man, you've gotta bring some of these stories back. That was great, man. You've got some good ones.
He does. I got racing ones, which aren't as funny.
Right, rollerblades. Yeah. First, he was rollerblading and holding onto trucks and getting hitched in the ride, crashing his brains out on rollerblades, and the next thing you know, he's winding up back in the truck on a motorcycle. Well. Like I say, Doug, well, you've made it this long, so you're okay. You're doing all right. Alrighty, so we've got another audio clip. This was sent in by Scott Baldwin. Scott Baldwin, that's a longtime listener of the show there. I think he actually lives not too far from me. I think he's a North California guy, like above a little bit above the Bay Area, maybe, possibly. I was kind of reading his stories with him and Jules. We had some go backs and emails, but he... in sending us a recording in. So let's go ahead and listen to what Scott sent us in. Here we go.
A story about the vast gulf between club racers and professional racers. One day, back in the day, I decided to take my RG500 street bike out to Willow Springs and see how it went out there, because I bought it to race it. So I'm out there, and they pitted next to these guys who were local Willow Springs hot dogs, you know, serious open class bikes, fast guys. And it turns out the same day that I was out there, Anthony Gobert had convinced Vance and Hines to bring the whole 45-foot truck and the entire crew out to Willow Springs so he could get familiar with the Ducati, which he had just signed to ride for Vance and Hines. So what the track day organizers decided to do upon seeing Gobert was insert a pro session into the schedule, where at the end of every hour from 50 to 0, the pros only would go out, and all the rest of us just have to lose 3 minutes out of our sessions. So that was going good, and Gobert was going out, I guess, and the guys next to me were going out in the pro session too. And then after the 2:50 to 3 o'clock pro session, this guy comes in to the pit next door, and he's like, he takes off his helmet, he's walking around like he's in shock, and he goes, talks to one of his friends, and I just sit there next to him. He says, I was going into turn 3, I was hard on the brakes, and Gobert came by me upshifting. There you go. We got a local big-time track specialist going into a hard-braking corner, and Gobert came by upshifting. That's just mind-blowing that he could do that. I've got a couple other stories about that too, but this is a good one for today. Enjoy the podcast. Bye.
Alrighty, Scott. Thanks for sending that in. That, there is a vast gap, right? I think we've all kind of had this experience with this kind of thing going in, and especially with other riders. But yeah, that's pretty nuts. That's pretty nuts. But still, very cool story. Thanks for sending that in. Much appreciated. And you said you have more, so feel free to send some more of those stories in. We really enjoy this new format.
Yeah, the part of the story that I like is that his buddy sees Gobert going into 3 upshifting, and I'm wondering if Gobert was just braking a whole lot later and he was backshifting, because most professional racers have the gearbox the other way around. So pulling up is downshifting as opposed to the other way around. But I don't know. I wasn't there. Didn't see it. But I think you're right, Scott. I got two of those stories. I got one when Miguel Duhamel blew past me at Mid-Ohio, and the other one where Rich Oliver blew around the outside of me at turn 14 at Road Americas on a 250. So, you know, I get all kinds of stories like those. But yeah, the gap is unreal between what, you know, we amateur club racers, track day guys are, and then the guys that are actually making a living from it.
Oh, for sure. I had a big experience that one. The first ever track day I did, I was on a supermoto bike and I was feeling good. I started feeling fast. I went into a corner and I stuck my foot out, and Elena Myers was behind me. And at this time, she was probably all of about 11 or 12 years old. And she took her front tire and used her front tire to push my front foot, or to push my foot out of the way and go up the inside of me through the corner, and then wheelied out and waved at me, and she went by, and I was like, okay, cool, yep, that's awesome. Same thing happened on a track day going to turn 10 at Thunder Hill. I was on the brakes hard. I was like, yeah, this is how you do it, this is how you get in here. And then Beaubier went flying by me backing it in, and he kind of looked over at me as he was going to this corner, dropped it in, slid the back in, and kept on going out. And I was like, yep, that right there. That is the difference. Oh boy.
Yeah. I get one more, but it's a dirt track one. So we're in this little place called Frankfort, Indiana, and it was an odd half mile. And by odd, I mean the fact that you're in the Midwest and the track is all clay. So there's no pea gravel or limestone over top of it. And this thing would groove into a blue groove. And it was, for whatever reason on this track, I gelled with that track. I was really pretty quick on my 600 Rotax. Man, I'm there. And we get to the main, right. And it's like, we were like the day before, we were riding on like the Friday night before the Saturday night Indy Mile, right? So I think the guy's name was, he was national number 80. I think his name was Rich King. He's from Iowa. Where's Scott when you need him, right? Some Motodog 650 would know exactly who I'm talking about. Anyway, so I'm pretty sure his name was Rich King. Anyway, I grabbed the hole shot in the main, and I'm going. I'm thinking, I'm going to beat him. That was all I wanted to do, was I wanted to beat him. Man, I led that first lap. I'm thinking, yes, I got this. Just got to hang on for, like, you know, seven more. You know, this, there's nothing right? to this. Second time in turn one, man, I just fly into that turn probably deeper than I've ever driven a motorcycle into any turn ever.
Especially when you feel good,
and I got my foot down, bike sideways, and also
nothing.
There goes Rich King, both feet on the peg, sideways with the throttle wide open.
I mean, and I think anyone that does any sport or anything,
I still finished second, but I mean, he totally blew my ass away.
And they come across a pro, even when they're at their peak, and they see what that pro is at, they're just like,
oh yeah,
damn, like wow, like. I didn't even know that was physically possible. Jeez. Yeah. All right.
I think that's the best description. It is a guy who's a professional somehow bends the laws of physics that you don't understand.
Right?
Marquez is the king of this, right? I mean, how many times, you know, he's just the prime example, right? Other guys do it too. But you see him crash, but not crash, numerous times. I mean, he defies physics. And that happens all the time. I mean, you know, if anybody's ever been to Road America, that turn 14, you know that's not really a place to be around, going around anybody around the outside. Yet Rich King went around me like it was no problem. Like literally, he had a rail and a groove cut into the track that was right there for his 250. I mean, you know, but that's the difference. They can somehow modify the rules of physics to benefit them, and that's the most important part. And that is the it factor. That is the touch, the feel, the whatever it is that you and I can't find, that ability to walk on that fine line and be able to stay on the correct side of it is what makes those guys great. And you can even see it in guys who are far better than what will ever be racing in MotoGP. You can see there's sort of the haves and the have-nots of that. Yet the skill of the have-not who's riding, you know, 12th, 13th, 14th place in MotoGP is so far beyond the level of what I could comprehend or do.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not even fair that I should talk about anything they do, but I do anyway because I...
You know, hey, we love a good armchair quarterback on this show.
Oh, yeah, everybody does.
We have all the answers. So. Something like that.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, living a life of fantasy. Cool. All right. So, perfect. Yes. All right, cool. Well, thanks, guys, for sending in. And we do have some actual listener feedback through the old emails. So, we'll jump into that. Keith Kovac, another longtime listener of the show. And he's written us a few times, but he wrote us in this week, or I guess it would be last week at this point. Hey, guys, wanted your opinion on Moto America. One, what is the story behind why Yoshimir Suzuki decided to leave? Does that mean that there is no longer any factory effort other than Yamaha? Secondly, should there be a new refocus on teams in a similar manner that is like BSB? Specifically, there being no full factory teams, but factories are willing to provide some support. I'm really wanting to see Moto America succeed like the AMA series was back in the day of Hayden, Spies, Mladen, and so on. And its final question is, do you think adding a historic race like the Daytona 200 to the calendar will build more excitement and entice factories to be more active? What say you guys? All right, Jim, so we'll tackle this, you know, one by one here. Do you know why Yoshimir Suzuki left after all these years? They even stayed. They made it through the DMG years. They all the way back to AMA. They've been with AMA, DMG, Moto America for quite some time, and they finally decided... No more. We're done.
I don't think it's Yoshimura that won it out. Because, you know, I don't know the true story. No one's written the true story of it. But I got to ask myself, Yoshimura's there. They're there with their Suzuki bikes. Suzuki comes and says that they're basically not going to partner with you anymore. And they've now decided to partner with Road Racing World with Chris Ulrich, you know, was founded by John Ulrich, right? And they're going to do that. That's where their support's going. That's where Suzuki's support is going. Well, you know, let's be real. Yoshimura ran those bikes because of the money and the support that Suzuki gave them.
Mm-hmm.
And if they don't have that support, they're not going to be able to go racing. But it doesn't mean that Yoshimura is out of the series. Now, there's still always that possibility that they will essentially buy their own bikes or whatever and do that. But there's a lot more underlying in that story than what anybody has dug up as of yet. And, you know, here in America, you're not going to find very much on those kind of stories in any major news network. There are, you know, internet stories and stuff, but you don't know how much you can, none of them are from really reputable sources, and a lot of it's very opinionated. So we'll have to wait and see, like, what is the real reason with that. Now, on the second little part about that, is that leave only Yamaha as a factory team? Well, no, Yamaha, they bolted too. So there is no more factory Yamaha, but there is Attack Yamaha, which is getting support from the Yamaha factory. So basically, Keith, what Moto America is now is what BSB is. We're moving that way where we have these, I don't know if you want to call them franchised teams or whatever, but you have these essentially, how can I put this, more professional independent teams. Independent team is what I'm looking for. You have these more independent teams that are now being supported by factory support. So, you know, is that a bad thing? Is it a good thing? I don't know. BSB is very successful with what they're doing, and they're probably the premier, what am I looking for here, Skyler? The premier country-oriented
racing series?
Motor racing. Yeah, racing series. So we're sort of like the CEV in Spain, right? Mm-hmm. It's sort of CEV in Spain, British superbikes, and then
right, so
where else do you have?
Basically, British superbike, right? They're setting the bar for domestic series, right?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. That's, yeah.
And, you know, which is true, right? We've seen this work out very, very well for BSB, and it is good to try to imitate what works, but you do have to look at certain factors with BSB. First of all, superbike and motorcycle racing in Great Britain is huge, massive. BSB can actually draw bigger crowds than World Superbike, and I don't know if it can draw bigger crowds than MotoGP, but MotoGP only goes to Great Britain once a year, so probably the overall crowds through all the races of BSB gulf that of what MotoGP does in the year in that country. So Moto America doesn't quite have that following, but that's a double-edged sword, because do they not have that following because the racing isn't as competitive, or do they not have that following because they don't have as big as sponsorship? Personally, it's kind of, you got to be able to put a product out there to get it on TV. And the moment you have a good product on TV, the fans will start coming to you, right? It works like anything else in the entertainment industry. Good product can lead to big success. Bad product, well, maybe if you have good marketing, you can get it to work, but most likely it's going to fail. So me, I think it's a new move. I think it's actually a good move, because if there's one thing we've seen over the last, well, pretty much since the inception of Moto America after they took over DMG, is that there were a lot of good privateer teams that stepped back. I mean, even Attack only came back, what was it, last year, and they took a hiatus. We had Mean Motorsports, that was a, you know, great team. They're the ones that kind of, they started off in like a 25-foot trailer helping Cam Beaubier when he was back in 600s, and built themselves all the way into a big, you know, full semi-truck, superbike, you know, team with Josh Herron. And then Mean was just like, dude, I'm not going to put all this money into this series to be able to compete for fifth place or back, because the factory guys have way more than we could ever want. Even just the amount of money they were spending on electronics. What was Yamaha using? The one that the Italian one. I can't think of it. Magneti Marelli.
Magneti Marelli. Yeah,
they were using that. And they, you know, we even talked about this on the show, how insane that was. And World Superbike factory teams couldn't even get that to work for them, like with Honda. So I don't see anything bad with rolling back to a very strong privateer series that can attract sponsorship later, after we have 10 guys every weekend who could win it. Because I think we think there's a huge gulf of talent possibly in Moto America, where the guys running up front are just that much better than the guys running behind them. But I don't think that's quite the case. I think the guys who are up front are there for a reason, and they're on the best bikes because they earn to be on those best bikes. But at the same time, the gulf is it's very small. There's a very small between the top 10 guys in Moto America. And if teams see it to be more affordable to get into the Superbike series, and that's, to be honest, the one that's going to make them the money, they want to pull teams out of Super Sport and out of Stock 1000. They want them to come to the big show. They need 20 superbikes on the grid, of which 10 of those guys could win any weekend, and that series will take care of itself.
Mm-hmm. You know, again, you know, having this kind of a formula where you're kind of in your garage porting heads and doing that kind of work, think about the names from the past who could show back up. Arian. Mm-hmm. Arian could grab a couple of Hondas and be good.
Let's do it.
You know, you had two brothers back in the day, right?
Let's do it.
So, you know, so they could come back. I mean, you had people like Rob Muzzy, who was a Kawasaki specialist, right? So you could get someone else to take that mantle up, right? I mean, we know the Kawasaki is a really good superbike, but yet nobody's racing it in America prominently, right?
Only in Superstock.
So you, yes, sorry, only in Superstock. But, you know, you have all this. You could get, you know, now if you got the money, you could have a Ducati and maybe run up front. The problem is going to be that now they're going to have a very strict electronics policy.
Yes.
That's the next thing, because let's face it, everybody's stock electronics units on the bikes are pretty damn sophisticated for what you get, right? With the anti-wheelie, trash control, etc.
Well,
but they're not all equal, right?
Right, because I remember in BSB, the Suzukis, they had to like back their electronics down because they had some crazy like electronics where they had like dual cams on the motors, and depending upon...
Oh, that was BMW.
Was it BMW that did BMW. That? Yeah, where they had to like... Yeah,
yeah, yeah, like, BMW's got like their own VTEC where the cams will shift at a certain RPM.
And so they had, like,
so they had to wire it on the one cam because the MoTeC, or is it... Somehow I think BSB uses MoTeC, and the electronics weren't developed to give the computer to give the bike that signal to change that cam lobe, right? So they can only run on the one cam. Well, that isn't necessarily fair, and that makes that bike not as competitive, but that's where we are. Moto America's got to take a real hard look and go, okay, we got to come up with, everybody gets the same spec electronics unit, right? And if they're going to do it fair, they should just get somebody like MoTeC, Mainady, Morelli, take your pick, right, to sponsor the Superbike series and give the Moto America themselves all the units, right? So then they're collected off of all the bikes at the end of a weekend, right? And then you go to the track the next weekend, you're given this ECU that you put into your bike, and it runs, right? And the deal then is that nobody can say, well, you're cheating, because everyone's got to turn it all back in again, and they're all randomly reassigned, right? And they're sealed, so nobody knows that you're cheating. You're going to have to implement that, because, I mean, I've seen it in bikes, I've seen it in car racing. I mean, I know a guy it was a 3/4 midget sprint car, right? The ones that run with the motorcycle engines and stuff.
Yep.
This dude was blowing everybody away, right? And everybody and their brother thought this guy was totally cheating. And the cool part about it was, inside of his car, there was a component that was all duct taped over, and every time they had the hood off the car, they'd cover it with rags. So everybody thought, that's what they're cheating. They're cheating. They're cheating. There's no way around this. They got something that we're not allowed to have, and it's right there. It's in there. So finally, they raised the money for the protest, right? And they get there, and they take this thing open, and everybody gets to see what it is. All it is was a cigar box with a couple wires ran into it that did absolutely nothing. They weren't even attached to anything, but yet you swore they were cheating, right? Mm-hmm. So the same thing will happen in Moto America if we don't do that. You know, so this is at a real crossroads right now. We are at a very big crossroads, because now you don't have the factories listening or having your ear, right? Like, the factories aren't going to dominate with what they want out of the series. Now it's, well, what does Wayne Rainey and company want out of the series? If you want a very competitive, very close series, you'll go to spec tires, spec electronics, and everybody goes and has a great day. You know? I mean, you could build them all as 1,000cc super sport bikes. Say, hey, you can't mill the heads, you can't flow the heads, you can change the exhaust, you can, you know, use this ECU unit that we're going to give you. And you can, you know, change the internals of the suspension, or you could put forks on and put suspension on the back. You'd have great racing. And that's what Dale Quarterly said like 2 years ago. I think he was on the show, right? I think Phil Hall had him interview from the Island Classic, right? And he said, you know, the way you have to take racing in America is you need to go back and have it so that everybody is competitive and the bikes are basically even and the great riders will become to the top. And it's sort of that same thing. You've said it on the show a million times. Ben Spies went and beat the world because he beat the crap out of Matt Mladen because Matt Mladen was that good. So if people will stand up and take notice of what you accomplish if the racing is close and tight and technical and everybody and you win all the time, people will look at that and go, yeah, that guy's fast. He's fast because he's able to make his bike work or he's able to do X with a motorcycle. That'll get you to World Superbike. That'll get you to World Supersport. That'll get you a Moto2 ride, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's where we got to go. I mean, if we want that, that's where we got to go. It's a watch this space kind of moment, right?
Right. So you did mention bringing up some classic races such as the Daytona 200, and would that bring more like pageantry and more viewership?
No.
There is room for, I think, diehards of yesteryear to really enjoy the 200. I don't think that I think that once it's gone for a few years, people who are getting into the sport or watching it now, it's not going to be a make or break that race is there. And to be honest, that race is still super dangerous.
One, it's super dangerous, and two, you've got to build all these quick change wheels and all this other stuff for it, and quick dump fuel cans and all that. Nope. You know, if you really wanted to do something cool, you could do a.
I got it. If you want to see something cool that would appeal to us racers, I think quite a bit, but can also drive in some other backing of weird sponsorships, is you can have a transatlantic battle.
There you go.
Where
the old match races,
the top 10 from BSB and the top 10 from Moto America, they meet at one track in the US and one track in Great Britain. And they have, you know, these races at the end of the season when the championships are over and you know, it no longer matters. But these are going to be this one off where they get the rules aligned so closely that they can race against each other, you know, to a fair point. And then just, you know, do the us versus them kind of thing. That'll drive a huge audience who may not even be that interested in motorcycles, but they love to get behind a little country rah-rah and get things going.
That's
I think that
idea.
Would be super cool to see. And it brings the media from both sides. So everybody gets to see who everybody else is. There's a lot of cohesion and intermingling on it. So I think that'd be awesome. And it's a big, big expenditure to go from, you know, overseas for both outfits. But with the right sponsorship and backing and kind of getting everybody, you know, together to do this at the same time, I think it'd be possible sometime down the road, especially if Moto America gets everything going.
I say you do it on neutral ground in Assen.
Ooh. Okay. Well, BSB races at Assen, so that can't even be neutral
anymore.
Yeah,
I know, but essentially it's not in England, right? They've had a couple of years there, but
I got it for you. We'll do it this way, because since Valencia is the last race of the year, it's also the last race of the motorcycle racing season in most series, right? Moto America's done. BSB is done. Yeah. That's where the race gets held. In Spain, during the MotoGP weekend,
you mean as a support race for what's going on there in Valencia?
Yep, exactly.
Oh, I love that.
There you go.
I love that.
And then that's a win for the racers because they get the MotoGP teams get to see them. Moto2 teams get to see them.
That's a win-win-win.
Oh, yeah. It's just a huge party. Oh.
Oh, yeah.
That
I think it's great.
Great.
That's awesome. That is awesome. That is actually brilliant.
We'll get a few of the Aussie Superbikes up there,
Who's
too.
Who's got Wayne Rainey's number? Anybody out there? Wayne, if you're listening to the pod, call Skyler. He's got ideas to save your series.
All right. So I think that kind of brings us to the end. Did I miss any emails this week? Oh, I did miss a couple. Excusez-moi. Let me get back here for a second. Longtime listener again and constant writer in and donor, Gary Shavit wrote in. He just has a bit of a funny one here. He goes, "Hi, all. Are you tired of watching or rewatching old races? Check out Jelly's Marble Run on YouTube. Regards, Gary." So these are kind of funny. These are for any of us that have a serious sickness with racing and are really missing it. What they do is they create a course and they number marbles. They're good sized marbles and they put them at the top of the course. And much like the Pinewood Derby cars, you just let them go down these random tracks and they commentate with like extreme vigor and everything else on these marbles. He's coming up the upside. Oh, he's to the left. It's exciting, but You'll think this is stupid, and you start watching, and you realize you've been sitting there for 10 minutes watching this, like, I was entertained. This is ridiculous.
Oh, yeah, me too. It's just, It's where we are in the world now. Yeah, we're so starved.
Oh, man. I just thought that was kind of ridiculous, but still, it's something to check out. We've got plenty of time. A lot of us are still at home, so there you go. A little bit of YouTube. Kill yourself some good 15, 20 minutes watching those. So,
yeah.
All right. And Scott Baldwin actually sent us a second email about a Baja International Tourist Cup, which is a real roads race in Baja, which is the theme. Wade Boyd had posted this up. And I got to say, this looks crazy, as in like crazy good, but holy crap. I can't imagine adding a new roads race during the current, you know, how the world is going and how hard the TT has to fight to keep that thing going. And it's got, you know, how many years of tradition? I mean,
over 100 years.
To start a new one, it 9.95 miles in length, 22 turns through the high desert there. That's pretty gnarly. I can see it doing well, you know, attracting a lot of attention, but I mean, the first couple times someone goes kersplat, that's going to be hard to sustain.
Yep, there's no question about that. I mean, I love the idea of racing on the roads, but I don't want the TT to ever end, right? But there is a lunacy to it, right? At some point, just like we always go to car races, so we'll use the car racing analogy. They used to have the Mille Miglia in Italy, and so it was literally you raced around Italy with a co-driver, and the roads were not closed. They were still, all the cars, all the trucks, all the everything were still using the roads that you were going to use. They stopped it because it was insane, you know? I mean, that's essentially where we are with this. I mean, more power to them if they can accomplish it and pull it off. I mean, you know, they've had all these people who want to get rid of the Baja race and the trucks down there and all that kind of stuff. And you know, environmentalists, like you're tearing up the desert, et cetera, and on and on and on. And I get it, folks. I understand where they're coming from and the whole nine yards. But, you know, I mean, I hope they do it. I hope they accomplish it. I hope that we don't ever not have roads racing, because it's exciting.
We always will. The Irish are nuts, so they'll keep that going.
Yeah, they are very much so, yes. I know, I've been there a few times with
like nuts in a good way. Been there a few times. You gotta have some of those crazy boys. We got Aussie grit. We got the crazy Irish. I mean,
crazy Irish.
Oh, it's good stuff.
Oh, I agree. Yeah, it's all good. It's all good stuff.
So, all right. Well, I think we've actually come to an end here, Jim. We've managed to fill another show up with, you know, good submissions from our fans writing in and our constant battering and running off topic, which is always a good time. But so we'll go ahead and wrap it up here. Remember, folks, you can send us your feedback and thoughts, questions, or even a quick audio blurb, as you heard today. You know, try to keep it short. If you do, 5-10 minutes is preferable. You can send that into motopod@motopodcast.com. That goes to all the hosts. Even if you just want to write just, you know, the usual email, just send it in. It's great. We love reading about it, talking about it on the show. Don't forget, we're also on Facebook, and that's at facebook.com/motopod. That's the Motopod fan page. I say this every week, but I'm going to say it again. I really need to get back to updating that on a regular basis, because I'm pretty sure I used to get a lot of good conversations going there, and I just have not been focusing on that. On Twitter, we are @moto_pod. You can follow us there for any news, announcements, and general motorcycle banter. On Twitter and Instagram, I can be found @SkylarV28. Jim, where can people find you?
I'm on Twitter and Instagram with the same handle, @MotoRGV.
Perfect. All right, folks. So hopefully now that we've kind of got this audio thing figured out and we got the programs and everything else, we'll get back to a more regular basis of just getting this show up and talking motorcycles. So I, even after recording this, I probably still have 2 days worth of editing, because behind the scenes, this took us about 6 takes to get right, I think. So...
when doesn't take us 6 takes to get anything right? Come on.
But this was harder. I had to figure shit out on the fly. So, well, we figured it out. And then we figured out why we had an issue, because we had some trial software that I had to get a license for. And then we figured that out too. So, hey, it's all just learning. I'm no audio expert.
This is like becoming work. I got to figure out problems.
Seriously, this is not cool. I've been in here for like 3.5 hours. I'm like, oh, my wife is going to kill me. I have not been doing any. I sat here all day doing work. I got up for 40 minutes, had dinner, and I sat right back down, and I've been down here, you know, for another 2 hours, and I'm like, oh, Damn it. I need to go outside. I'm going to go for a walk is what I'm going to do after this. Get some fresh air.
You do that, I'm going to go to sleep.
All right, Jim. It was great talking to you, man.
All right, man. Until next time.